Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host is grateful to the people who subscribe to this program, including Nicholas Yaksich, Cynthia Clark, Linda Gray, and Andrew Krieger. You can join that list. Go to peterbcollins.com.
The present situation is abstract. Listen.
I'm glad you're listening. Later in this podcast, we're going to talk about the so-called war on religion and the Catholic Church crackdown on American nuns.
Six long days, and I'm highly embarrassed every time I get my pay. And they're working everybody, Lord, they're working poor folks to death. And when you pay your rent and your car note, you ain't got a damn thing left. Ain't that a bitch?
Yes, it is.
Somebody doing something slick.
Over at the United States Supreme Court, has somebody been doing something slick? You know, just changing a word or two in the caption of a suit before the court could have dramatic implications. We continue our series, this is part five, on the effort to overturn the absurd Citizens United decision that the Supreme Court issued about 2 years ago that has unleashed millions, if not billions, in corporate cash into the political campaign system this year. The challenge comes from the great state of Montana, which 100 years ago, by a popular initiative, enacted a ban on corporate contributions to political campaigns in that state. The Supreme Court is reviewing it and has to make a decision. They can deny the case, in which case the Montana decision would stand, effectively overturning Citizens United in the state of Montana and possibly elsewhere. Or they could take the case and put it through the process of oral arguments and then hold a hearing, which would probably all push it back until after this November's election. Using the 11th Amendment, attorneys are arguing that the Supreme Court does not have jurisdiction over this case. And that's what we've been discussing with Adam Furgatch, with attorney Carl Mayer, and returning today to join us is attorney Rob Hager. Rob, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back, Peter. It's good to talk to you again.
And I think I've once again summarized pretty accurately the basis here for our whole discussion about the impending moves by the Supreme Court related to this Montana appeal. And yesterday in our podcast with Carl Mayer and Adam Furgatch, we did touch on an issue that you and I are going to go into some detail about today, and that is that it's been discovered that internally at the Supreme Court, someone has changed the nomenclature. They have changed the name of the filing in this case, and as I alluded, it may have a dramatic impact. First of all, we want to credit Charlie Cray and reporter Russell McIver, who writes for the Corporate Crime Reporter based in Washington. And McIver went to the court and actually looked at these files and then asked the clerks there how it came that the original filing, which was under the name of the appeal from Montana, American Tradition Partnership versus Bullock, Bullock being the attorney general of the state of Montana, that has now been changed. So, Rob, first of all, tell us about the procedures here. Who can change the name of a case file at the Supreme Court?
What a good question. Normally, lawyers think that if you want to get the name of a case changed after you filed it, you have to file a motion and get the permission of the judge, who's going to take a hard look at what your reasons are. Now, for example, one possible legitimate reason would be, say, a corporation changed their name or an individual changed their name legally. You make a motion, you inform the court of that, give some evidence. The court says, okay, we'll change the name of the case. In this case, actually, both names were changed. It started out as Western Tradition Partnership in Montana, and that's the name of the Montana Supreme Court case as it was decided and reported in the official reports.
Now, let me just be clear, Western or American? Because I have it as ATP.
Well, that's what I'm about to explain, is that it was Western when it was in Montana. But as we understand, Western changed its name to American in after the case was decided in Montana, before they filed their petition for cert, or actually their petition for stay, which they did first, and so they were using the name American when it went into the Supreme Court. Now, an interesting little side note on this is that when the Supreme Court changed the name of the defendant in the case, which is what you're introducing as the subject here, the court actually misused the name of the Western, the earlier name, which was kind of surprising because the only documents they had were under the name American. So this led us to think, well, maybe this was a deal that was done, you know, back when the name of the company was still Western, because otherwise, where did the Supreme Court get this name from? The only one they saw was the name American, which is what all the documents to them came as.
Wow. Keep going. This is getting very interesting.
Yeah. It's even more interesting when you start with that. Okay, so then the second part is the title of the case. You always have a V in the middle, standing for versus.
Right.
Yeah, the plaintiff or the appellant, as the case may be, and that's the first name. That's American, as it was filed. And when they filed their first document, they filed it against the Attorney General of Montana and the Commissioner of da-da-da, two offices. They didn't name any names, and that's the way they had done the case in Montana. That was the name of the case coming out of the Montana Supreme Court. Somehow, after all the documents have been filed on the stay proceeding in February, in 2 days between the time that Montana had filed their opposition using the correct name as it was used in by the Montana Supreme Court, the name changed. 2 days later, an order is issued, February 17th, and all of a sudden it has a different name. And that's what Charlie Cray, when he went over to the court, tried to get the court to explain. I thought he wrote a rather amusing story of getting the runaround over there, getting inconsistent explanations from them, and ultimately not getting any explanation.
Yeah, he compared it to a day at the DMV.
Right, exactly. I thought he made a nice story out of it, actually, of not being able to get the Supreme Court to explain to a reporter how the name of this case changed. They couldn't explain it. Now, we could take it from there, but it would probably be good to step back into why is this of any significance. I mean, first of all, I think we can all assume that this doesn't happen normally. Cases don't change their names. This isn't something that ordinarily happens. And then, but why would it be significant if it does? And so that's where we back into, really the title of this story is, how the Supreme Court changes the Constitution without going through the process the Constitution has established for changing the Constitution, which is a very complex process. You have to get two-thirds of Congress, both houses of Congress, to agree. You have to get three-quarters of the states to agree. It's not an easy process at all. But the Supreme Court, after the 11th Amendment was passed, when they got chastised very soundly by the whole country for trying to extend their powers and claiming jurisdiction over cases that are brought by private individuals or corporations against the state, and the 11th Amendment said, you can't do that, never intended you to be able to do that, and so we're telling you right now that this Constitution may not be construed to include the judicial power to decide such cases. The court lived with that for a long time, but after the Civil War, and we got into the period where the Civil War amendments were no longer used to protect former slaves, but they were used to protect railroads against state regulations in that era, which President Obama, a month or so ago, you know, during the health care case, while it was being argued in the Supreme Court, he used the term the Lochner era, L-O-C-H-N-E-R, after a case in 1905 where the Supreme Court decided that New York bakers' hours of work could not be regulated by New York State. Preposterous idea. They just said it violated the 14th Amendment. In that same era, they decided a case in 1908 called Ex Parte Young that said that the Supreme Court can, notwithstanding the 11th Amendment, allow a private party to bring an injunction action, any act in which they then clarified later as saying anything that was for prospective relief. In other words, telling somebody what to do, telling the state what to do,
okay,
what laws they could enforce and can't enforce. That they could do that, provided they didn't actually sue either the state or any arm of the state, which would be an office of the state or an agency or, you know, a bureau or anything like that, as long as they don't sue the establishment of the state itself. If instead they sue an individual officer, of course, the state can't act without other than going through their individual officers, so if they can accomplish anything they want this way. If you sue the individual officer in their individual capacity, that's the rule. And so this was, and it's been acknowledged by the Supreme Court itself, this is a fiction. This is a lie, in other words. Mm-hmm. This is a fraud. In other words, they're saying, well, you can go ahead and do the same thing. You can actually sue the state if you just change the name of the party, and we'll pretend that it's, we'll just pretend it's against an individual, though we know it's not. We're telling the state what to do, but we'll do it through their officials, and this way we get around the 11th Amendment. As I say, it was called fiction. But the trouble was that not many lawyers really understood it. Things got very complex, and not many lawyers actually understood that the court was basically, in order to extend their own powers, was asking them to tell a lie. They want to sue the state and say, well, just pretend you're not, and we'll pretend you are. And so what happens, now we can bring it up to date in this case, once that's understood, that that's the situation. So in this case, the lawyers didn't understand the rule. They sued the state, and that was okay in Montana. Montana has their own laws that allowed people to, individuals, corporations, to bring suits against them.
Mm-hmm.
That's up to Montana. Each state has its own rules. Montana allowed it. But as soon as that case moves out of the state into the federal courts, in this case the Supreme Court, you run into that bar of the 11th Amendment.
Right.
Now, somebody in the Supreme Court understood that. Now we don't know, we have some suspects, because the case actually went originally to Justice Kennedy.
Well, let me just advance one suspect whose initials are AK.
I'll go along with that hypothetical.
Those initials are those of the individual who wrote the Citizens United decision. It was engineered by Chief Justice Roberts, but he assigned it to a man with the initials AK. We also know, and this is something that I have learned from these podcast interviews with you and Carl Mayer and Adam Fergatch, the history here, that Justice Kennedy, along with the four identified conservatives on the court, have all been strong advocates of states' rights and the use of the 11th Amendment to promote that.
Correct.
So we have, I'm trying to work here in legal terms, we have a circumstantial case, we have a means, and we have a potential motive.
Right, and we have knowledge, because as you pointed out, Kennedy, I'd say of those four justices, he's the one that has written most extensively and most knowledgeably about the 11th Amendment, so he understands it. Probably of any, I would just say of any justice sitting on the court today, Justice AK is the one who knows most about it and would see this issue coming from a long way away. In other words, he would have been very interested in the fate of his his little baby, the Citizens United decision, the much criticized decision.
Let me just clarify on procedure
sure.
here as well, because I'm an amateur when it comes to watching the court. But each justice is assigned a certain number of states or a region from which appeals are directed.
Certain types of appeals.
Okay.
Certain types, yeah.
And so did Justice Kennedy maneuver for the Montana appeal, which originally came as an order or a request for an order to stay the Montana Supreme Court's decision in this case. Did that come on the natural, or did he somehow maneuver to be the point person on the court to dispose of this action coming from Montana?
I don't think it was a maneuver, and here's my reasoning, is that the assignments of these judges to the various regions, usually they like to follow as much as possible their home state. In this case, Kennedy comes from California, and he's been assigned the Ninth Circuit mm-hmm. as the circuit that he covers, and Montana is part of the Ninth Circuit. So
All
it
right.
appears to me to be just an accident that it happened to come to the judge who wrote Citizens United.
Okay.
That he, you know, that's in the natural duties that he has.
Mm-hmm.
But given that accident, then he probably felt himself most fortunate that he got to take a chance to take a first look at that. Now, the only maneuvering could have been, but again, it doesn't look too much like maneuvering, more a happy circumstance, is that when James Bopp, the lawyer on the other side, who seems pretty clever in what I've seen him do, the guy that basically strategized Citizens United and has worked on most of the cases about money and politics, actually. When he was considering going up to get a stay order, and that's the type of order that goes to the single justice, he may have been thinking that we want to get this into Justice Kennedy's hands as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So he can, you know, he's the guy we want to get this case to, so let's do a stay order. But then again, the stay order certainly worked for them, and they got it granted. And so they were able to put the Montana Corrupt Practices Act on hold here, as it has been since they got the stay order on February 17th. So,
and do we have any knowledge of the man with the initials AK and James Bopp going hunting, fishing together? They belong to the Bohemian Club.
Let's get some other reporters interested. I'm glad you're piquing that interest. There's a lot more to be looked into here, frankly.
Now, Rob, fundamentally here, there is no dispute that the name of the caption on the case did change somewhere on or about the 17th of February, 2012, at the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. Is that a fair statement?
That is correct.
All right. So when Charlie Cray went to the court and asked them how this got changed, he did indeed get the runaround. But what is the proper way to pursue this investigation? Do you sue the court? Do you sue the clerk in his or her official capacity? Or
well, here we go back to the story you've been telling here very well for a couple of your episodes, if I can call them that, where we're talking now about the Montana Attorney General. And why isn't he raising these issues? Because the thing for him to have done was to say, wait a minute, you just changed the name in this case. And now I'm somehow the defendant. Sorry, but you got this wrong. I'm the lawyer for Montana here. You know, cases don't just, like Charlie put it, don't just suddenly turn into being cases against the lawyer. You know, that isn't how it works.
Well,
know?
And it's a bizarre twist. It's a bizarre twist of personhood. This is state personhood.
Right. And so it was really up to the Attorney General to say, excuse me, Justices, but this case is against the Attorney General of Montana, whoever that may be. And it wasn't brought against me personally. The case is not against me personally. I didn't defend it against me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And it should not be in your case. It's an appeal from that case that came out of Montana. That wasn't against me personally. So it should not be against me personally in your court without an explanation. Now, the explanation I think I've made clear, just to hammer that home, is that, you know, with lawyers routinely making these kinds of mistakes, it may be that the court has routinely, and this is what we'd like to get at, does the court just routinely make the lie? They just lie for the for the lawyers when the lawyers don't know that they're supposed to tell a lie, you know, when they sue a state and pretend it's actually against an individual. So the court just steps right in there and tells the lie for them. And if they're doing that, this is the only circumstance in which they do that. And it shows some guilt, you know, a guilty mind about the fact that in this particular case of this 11th Amendment, this sort of tracks what they've done with the First Amendment and money in politics. That's what makes this so interesting, is that the Supreme Court has quite clearly changed the Constitution by creating this fiction. And the fiction is very similar to the fiction they created to change the First Amendment. And what they did with the First Amendment is they said, money is speech, like as if they were alchemists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, money is speech. Well, there's nothing in the Constitution, nothing the founders ever said that would lead you to believe that the First Amendment ever intended to protect money and property. It was there to protect speech, freedom of speech, not freedom of money to subvert speech. So it's a very similar fiction that they're really being attacked for by the Montana Supreme Court. And the fact that they have now invoked this similar fiction about the 11th Amendment, the way they also have amended the Constitution with the 11th Amendment is very similar to the way they've amended the Constitution with the First Amendment. And the question here is, when are the American people going to call the Supreme Court to account for amending their Constitution? This is the people's constitution. The Supreme Court does not own this constitution. It's the people's constitution. The people approved it through the states.
And Rob, just to put a finer point on it, without imputing motive here or trying to finger a specific suspect, changing the name of this case is not an insignificant clerical matter, because it would enable the court to accept this case and slide around the 11th Amendment bar on their jurisdiction to a private suit brought against a state government.
Precisely.
And so if this was intentional, and one has to imagine that it was, and the slip-up between American Tradition Partnership and Western Tradition Partnership, its prior name, raises even more questions here. And this doesn't, I can imagine that the court wants to just wave this away, and that many people who support Citizens United would feel the same way. But if we're really looking for an unbiased court to review this in an honest manner, we're seeing sleight of hand here used to wriggle out of your 11th Amendment claim.
That's entirely correct. That's entirely correct. I subscribe to every word you said. And that can take you to a further hermeneutics here of interpretation, is that the Supreme Court itself, or at least one important judge on the court, felt that this 11th Amendment argument was strong enough that they needed to try to slip around it, mm-hmm, by changing the name of the case, that they better, mm-hmm, do that to set themselves up to have a stronger argument when they have to take on this issue, which again makes it even more suspect. Why didn't Montana assert its rights? Didn't it assert sovereign immunity, which, again, we've talked about before several times?
And Charlie Cray explores in the first part of his coverage the decision by Steve Bullock to ignore the advice of Carl Mayer and Rob Hager and team, the 11th Amendment movement headed by Adam Fergatch. And what he reports is that Bullock is hell-bent on working this case. He's running for governor of Montana, and the opportunity to practice before the Supreme Court, he probably thinks, would be an arrow in his quiver as he runs for governor. And so they don't want the precedent to be set. They don't want the Supreme Court of Montana's decision to stand. He's looking for his 15 minutes of fame.
I think Charlie's made a good case for that. And the problem that the Attorney General has is that he has failed to give us. Now, remember, we started out as strong allies of the Attorney General. We were there volunteering to do anything we could to help them out. And at the end of the day now, we're in a position of saying, and this is the last day, this is the very last day as we speak on the 13th there, for him to file, in fact, just the last hours, it is exactly, literally the last hour, for him to get a motion in where he would simply assert the sovereign immunity of Montana. And he's failing to do that. But what he's also failed to do is to treat us as his colleagues and lawyers and give us any reason whatsoever. I mean, we're open. Give us a reason. He's in charge of the case. You know, give us what your judgment was. Why did you do this? So the first time, the only reason he gave us was this issue, well, he's afraid of the precedent it might set. And I personally responded to him with a rather lengthy explanation that there's really nothing to worry about setting precedent. And I think you and I have gone through that to some extent of why that is the case, that this is not going to be precedential for any issues that we could discuss that where you might be concerned about a state not abiding by the constitutional rights of citizens. It's not that kind of a case. And then we got no, well, in fact, I couldn't get an argument from Montana. I tried. I went to their smartest lawyer. You know, basically, I don't want to talk too much about who that is. I don't want to insult anybody. But, you know, I talked to, I think many people consider their smartest lawyer that's working with the AG's office, and tried to get him to make any negative comment whatsoever about our 11th Amendment argument so we could have a discussion about this, you know, make sure everybody's on the same page and we understand what the law is, what the cases say, and so forth. And I just could not get an argument. Period.
Was it like a deposition where you were getting simple one-word answers?
No, it was very cordial. It was very cordial, but it was just very clear that he did. He was not going to get into that discussion. He just was not. He didn't have any arguments to make. You know, I guess that wasn't the issue. The issue was that the Attorney General, and he did this in a way that would not be entirely quotable, you know, but, you know, that he was pointing in the direction that look, it was the chief legal officer of the state of Montana who made this decision with the consultations of other amicus, but we know who that is. We know that's New York State and a group of largely Democratic attorney generals who did file an amicus brief that was very similar to Montana's own brief, which basically attempts to revisit the issues of Citizens United, which we feel will get you 4 votes on the court.
Right.
And what we were trying to do is say, great, do those briefs, but we want to get the 5th vote. You know, so let's do that now. Let's have a strategy that's going to get that 5th vote.
Now let's impute the best possible motives to Steve Bullock's decision here. So he gets his way. The 11th Amendment argument is not presented. The case is not dismissed or summarily dismissed by the court. And it is set for oral arguments, and then the court will reach a decision probably well after the November election. As you point out, it's unlikely that the 5 justices who are still on the court who affirmed the decision in Citizens United just a little over 2 years ago, that they're going to change their minds. So what kryptonite does Steve Bullock have besides the 11th Amendment to defend the decision of the Montana Supreme Court? It appears that he wants to overturn the Montana decision by proceeding to get the Supreme Court in Washington to hear this case.
Right, and most very close observers of the court, even closer than I am, you know, who were writing about this, say that, look, this case of Montana could create more harm than good, because what's going to happen here by just asking them to redo Citizens United is they're going to strengthen the Citizens United decision and hammer it down. And it's not good to do that when the composition of the court hasn't changed, when you just know the result you're going to get.
Yeah.
So that's what good observers are saying is going to happen, and that's what Steve Bullock's walking into if he thinks he's going to have his day in the sun arguing his case before the Supreme Court. And so that's why we're going to continue. In other words, this decision is likely going to be made about whether or not the court is going to hear the case tomorrow. I'm told by the clerk's office that they expect the vote to be taken tomorrow. That'd be the 14th. But we don't stop on this, because in that circumstance that you described, which is possible, many people think it's not the most possible, but it is possible that the court does put this down for what's called plenary hearing. That is, you know, full hearing on the brief, scheduled, as you say, off into the fall when they come back for the new term. And then the decision, of course, is, as you say, unlikely to come any time before the election.
Yeah.
It could be argued before. That would be a Bullock's ideal scenario, would be he gets to stand up maybe mm-hmm. the week before the election, which is possible that it would be set down for that first month of the term, later in that first month.
October,
late October. Mm-hmm. And so that would be his ideal, that he's sitting up there, you know, arguing this case, making all kinds of platitudes about, you know, money and politics when it's going to be a hot issue this year. So that's, I think, what they're plotting out politically, that's what they want to happen. But we're going to stay on this case. We're going to continue right where we started a couple months ago, trying to get other attorney generals to file their briefs on the 11th Amendment, and we're going to be pitching to him, and we're going to be talking to the media again to put pressure on him that if he wants to win the case, then he has to actually do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't done it right so far, and now if it's a matter of losing the case. Now, if the other possibility happens is that they summarily reverse, we're still going to put pressure on him in two different ways. As there happens to be a case pending in U.S. District Court, I think we mentioned that before, in Montana, and we have been talking to Montana Attorney General about why aren't you filing your motion to dismiss in that case, because the argument is even stronger when you're in federal court.
Yeah.
For reasons I won't necessarily get into, and if you want to, but it is a stronger argument in federal court, so we're putting pressure on there. As soon as this case is over, we're going to turn our attention more to that district court case, and then. Beyond that, we have drafted a very brief piece of legislation that we want all the attorney generals to ask their congressional delegations to enact, which could just simply win the case for Montana if Congress would tack it on to almost any piece of legislation going through. We call it the 11th Amendment Enforcement Act.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple little piece of legislation that strips the Supreme Court of jurisdiction to hear any case against a state which challenges its laws regulating campaign finance,
mm-hmm.
money and politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rob, one last question, and that is, do you have any remedies available related to the change of the file name?
That's difficult. Oh, I'm glad you came back to that, because I did have a thought on that when we were talking about it, is that our feeling is that they were able to give Charlie Cray the runaround. But what we're looking for there is we'd like to see, you know, lip tack from the New York Times, or, you know, mm-hmm. we would like to see a prominent follower, Charlie Savage, you know, someone who's prominent to pick up this story and actually ask the court for an explanation and you know, from a source that the Supreme Court can't just give the runaround to and have to give them an intelligent answer. And so, you know, that's what we're looking for. I think that's what it's going to take. But no, you really can't sue the Supreme Court.
The internal actions of the court are beyond anybody's review.
They really are. They're the top court in the land. And the other remedy, again, is that I think that this just puts a little icing on the cake of the need for Congress to step in and to start to reassert itself against the Supreme Court. Supreme Court is just constantly reaching out for more and more power. And in our system, the check on the court is from, well, two sources, but at the federal level, it's from Congress. At the state level, it's the states by putting up some resistance to the court. But at the federal level, and ultimately, it's Congress. And if Congress, which it hasn't stepped in, and the reason is that they're perfectly comfortably corrupt, you know, in this system that the court has created.
Well, and Rob, this brings me back to a question I posed to you when we talked last time, and that is, can we count on the court to operate in an honest way and to review this in a way that doesn't pull punches or use sneaky tactics in order to preserve both the 11th Amendment issues that the same group of justices who embrace Citizens United do. And this Hobson's choice that your challenge, the 11th Amendment challenge, presents is something that I think they want to wriggle out of. And that's why I fundamentally am losing confidence in the Supreme Court in the manner in which it operates.
I wouldn't disagree with that at all. Totally agree with you. No, we have, I think it should be clear to everybody by now. It's not. I know it's not to some people, but people need to get used to that we have five political operatives now in control of the court. This happened in 2006 when Alito replaced Justice O'Connor. And we've been teetering right on the brink of this for many years. You know, this was a 5-4 court for many years. And when Alito replaced O'Connor, that was the final shift. It tilted it over to there are five justices who will now routine. A lot of people think of Kennedy being the middle, but he's never in the middle on any issue of power. And so we have five justices who really are tricksters. And they are there with a political agenda. They are not there to uphold the rule of law, uphold the Constitution. They are there to create and maintain a plutocracy in America. You know, they're benefactors. And they're on the court. These guys are not legal giants. We used to have people like Thurgood Marshall and Justice Frankfurter and Justice Holmes and, you know, well-known figures in the law who had succeeded in various areas of life, including politics. Justice Warren, governor of California, Justice Black, senator from Alabama, and so forth. We do not have a single elected politician right now on the court. You know, we have these bureaucratic functionaries, by and large, who are there for political reasons. They're there for ideological reasons. George Bush put on the most right-wing ideological judges he could find, as did Nixon when this all started. None of his judges are left, of course, but that's where it all started. And so we have right-wing ideologues who have a political agenda which is way to the right of mainstream America, and they're in control. We have a Congress who is supine in the face of this, just giving up their powers to the court, allowing the court to amend the Constitution without going through and so we really have to rely on either the states, on the one hand, to stand up to the court, which is what Montana is doing here, the Montana Supreme Court is doing, and we feel that the Montana Attorney General is not doing, or we, the people, have to start prioritizing this issue of money and politics and getting the Supreme Court out of this subject altogether. That is the solution. But we all have to get together and prioritize that issue, or it's not going to happen. No, we can, just as you said, totally subscribe to your statement that we cannot rely on these five justices to apply the law. And if anyone wants to, they can read Justice Stevens' 90-page dissent in Citizens United, and that's what he's saying in a very judicious and gentlemanly way. You know, Justice Stevens was a model of a true judge. He had a judicial temperament, and so you have to read that decision. But that's what he's saying there, is that these guys are just, they've divorced themselves from any fidelity to the law itself.
Rob, I appreciate your characterization of this court, and the only thing I would add for the edification of our listeners is a reminder of how young the conservative corporatist justices are, and that we have decades to run with them on the Supreme Court. And it just brings to mind my disappointment that Obama appointed two centrist, pro-government, pro-corporate nominees to the court when he could have put a full-throated liberal up there to attempt to really balance the court packing that has occurred in the last 15 to 20 years.
Well, I, again, have to totally agree with that statement. And I know many people, when they're looking at whether or not they're going to vote for Obama, him having really betrayed people in so many different areas, many of which I'm sure you've covered in other shows,
yep.
They make this argument that, well, what about the Supreme Court? But we have no assurances from Obama what kind of a justice he's going to appoint.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't have any clue who he's going to appoint. And in the case of Kagan, although I have to say that she's performed better on the court than I anticipated, she was the lawyer who lost the Citizens United case.
Yeah.
That's who she was. And she lost it while making a serious error in her argument of the case. She conceded the precedent that got overturned. She conceded that case was wrong. You don't do that. just as a lawyer, you learn as a junior lawyer that you never do that. You never concede issues to a court.
Yeah. Well, and
deal with it. And then they took her concession, just to follow that up. Sorry,
yeah.
But that they took that and mentioned it four times in different parts of their decision is the reason why they were overturning the decision. It was because Kagan had conceded the point. Now that was for the first case that she ever argued.
Well, and this is another practical reason why the Montana appeal should not be brought to this court, because both Kagan and Thomas, by all rights, should recuse themselves from anything to do with Citizens United.
That's true.
Rob, thank you for your expertise and for joining us today. We will continue our coverage here, and the fight goes on.
A great pleasure, Peter. Always enjoy talking to you.
Rob Hager here on the Peter B. Collins Show. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. This is podcast number 500. We started doing this about 3 years ago. And I am grateful to the listeners who support this program and spread the word to your friends and neighbors. Joining me now, Maureen Fiedler.
If God had a name, what would it be and would you call it to his face? If you were faced with
Maureen Fiedler is a Roman Catholic nun. She's a member of the Sisters of Loretto, and I've known her for over 10 years. I helped her start a public radio show that has just reached its 10th anniversary. It's called Interfaith Voices, and it's heard on stations all over the United States. Maureen Fiedler, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's good to be back talking to you.
Well, and tell us a little bit about your odyssey, because I think it's remarkable that you put together an hour-long show about religion every week. It's distributed on public stations, and in this hyper-partisan, kind of extremist culture that we live in today, you offer a very balanced approach to covering the news of religion every week.
Well, we try. And, Peter, I always say that a lot of that has to do with the fact that we were born out of the dust and rubble of 9/11. And much of what we do on Interfaith Voices is a desire to overcome divisions and bigotry and all of the religious divisions, particularly, that can plague any society. And so we cover all faith traditions. We try to do it fairly. We try to do it even-handedly, which is the way public radio is supposed to work. And we try to just offer as many different voices as we can to the general public. And consequently, we've had a steadily growing audience over the past 10 years.
And people can find your shows either at a local public radio station or online at interfaithradio.org.
That's right.
And why don't you give our listeners here just a quick sense of last week's show or this week's show, the range of views and voices that you offer on your program?
Well, let me give you just a few recent, what I would call lead interviews. One is with Madeleine Albright,
mm-hmm.
who used to be the Secretary of State, of course, under Clinton. And we talked about both her recently discovered Jewish roots
right.
and how she looks at questions of faith and international politics today. A couple weeks before that, we did what I regard as a very important interview on the conflict in Syria, which you hear about in the news as kind of a dictator confronting you know, an uprising in the populace of Syria. What you don't hear much about is that religion is at the root of that.
Sure, the Alawites, the Sunnis, the Shiites.
That's a very complex and layered society. And found out who the Alawites were and the Sunni majority and why they're, you know, is this literally violent opposition. We did that. Then, quite recently, we had on an Anglican priest named Michael Lapsley, who provided one of these inspiring interviews, but gripping. He was a virulent opponent of apartheid in South Africa and was forced out of South Africa, went to Zimbabwe, but the regime followed him with a letter bomb that literally blew up in his hands and blew his hands off, and he lost an eye. But he talked about that experience, but then he talked about how he's gone from what he was doing then, which was sort of a clerical freedom fighter in a certain sense, to being a healer, to being someone who was able to forgive even a horrific act like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very interesting. This week we're interviewing a conservative New York Times columnist, Ross Douthat, who has a new book called Bad Religion, who thinks we're a nation of heretics. Other weeks we've interviewed atheists. We very frequently interview Muslims. And we just have an intern for the summer who is a Buddhist and who's going to help us explore more deeply into the Eastern traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So, there
Very
you have
interesting.
It.
So, is there a war on religion in this country? And if so, how do you cover it?
Well, I don't think there's a war to cover. I'm not aware that there's a war. If you mean by the Obama administration, which is how it's usually used, against, say, the Catholic Church or people who oppose contraception or something, I don't perceive this as any kind of a war on religion. I think it's, you know, there's enormous respect for religious freedom in this country, and there has been a real attempt by the Obama administration to dialogue and compromise with these groups over, some of their specific objections to the health care reform law. So I don't see that at all. If anything, religion flourishes in the United States. And it's because we have no established faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly agree with your point there that there is no war on religion, but according to conservative Republicans, their religious freedoms are under assault. And I get daily emails from Jay Sekulow at the American Center for Law and Justice. He's a Pat Robertson-funded legal entity. Mm-hmm. And the hysterical calls from religious groups, including the Catholic bishops, really strike me as partisan politics that really should be separated from religion in a secular nation like ours.
Well, I agree with that. You're talking to somebody who believes very strongly in separation of church and state. And I think that religious denominations really step over the line when they get into partisan politics. In fact, even within the Catholic Bishops' Conference, there are some individual bishops that have begun to speak out and say, look, this campaign that's ostensibly about religious freedom is looking more and more like an anti-Obama political campaign, and who've said, we don't want any part of this. So the bishops themselves are not unified. You may remember they even initiated a lawsuit against this just a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
What's most interesting about that lawsuit, but got almost no coverage, the majority of Catholic dioceses in this country did not join that lawsuit. It was only a few and then a couple of colleges and universities that joined it. There were about 40 plaintiffs in that, but there are, you know, way more than 100 dioceses in the United States.
Well, the Vatican's field marshal in this war appears to be the newly minted Cardinal Dolan of New York.
Yes.
And he it's been pretty well disclosed that back in January, he had a video prepared. He had a PR firm that rolled out the video statement and the Catholic bishop's objection to the inclusion of birth control at no cost in insurance policies that were purchased by religious organizations, say Catholic universities and hospitals. And when we come back to Proposition 8 here in California, where the Catholic bishops aligned with the Mormon Church, and successfully ran a ballot measure to remove civil rights from gays and lesbians in a way that, you know, had no incursion on the right of the church to determine that in a particular religion that marriage would be confined to one man and one woman. And so as I see this more aggressive political participation, particularly by the leadership of the Catholic Church in this country, as a former Catholic, I am very uncomfortable, Maureen.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I think there's a, in some sense, there's a misplaced idea of where conscience resides. For example, when it comes to purchasing a health insurance policy, well, you and I purchase health insurance policies. We don't use everything that's in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say a religious institution purchases one. It's up to the person who's covered to decide whether or not to use, in this case, contraception. That's where conscience resides, it seems to me. And I think it's very interesting that when that controversy first came about, it was discovered that a number of Catholic colleges and healthcare facilities actually had health insurance policies with contraception coverage in them already.
Sure.
They evidently had no problem with it. So it's all in the eye of the beholder, but it's the conscience resides in the person making the decision.
Now,
and anyway, go ahead.
I don't know if you had the same reaction, but when Rick Santorum, representing, you know, a very extreme wing of the Catholic Church, was running for president and talking about contraception as some sort of a controversial issue. At
mm-hmm.
first, I thought it was a joke. I thought it was some sort of something that he had said that had been twisted. And then I saw the full interview in the full context, and he was serious. And when then the Catholic bishops picked this up, called it a war on religion, it struck me that they were siding with Rick Santorum as a candidate for president. And it also appears to me that the bishops are trying to get the American government to do what they are unable to do, which is to persuade, in particular, Catholic women not to use birth control.
It certainly, on the surface, looks like that, but when I heard all this news that you just laid out, I kept thinking, do these people never read the polls? I've been looking at polling that's done of Catholics in this country for the last 25, 30 years. The overwhelming majority, I mean, we're talking in the 80, 90% of Catholics approve of the use of artificial contraception without any moral problems. And, of course, the vast majority of Catholic women of childbearing age, in fact, do use it. So you wonder, you know, why don't you, you know, forget this one, fellas? You know? You've lost this battle. You know, you're not, the Catholic hierarchy is not required by Catholic teaching to turn every moral teaching of the church into a civil law.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're opposed to remarriage after divorce, but thank God, I don't want to give them any ideas. But there's no campaign going on to make that illegal. And so, you know, really, they ought to do the same with something like contraception.
And Maureen, could you clarify something for me and our listeners here? The use of birth control is not considered a mortal sin in the nomenclature and the policies of the Catholic Church. Am I correct?
You know, I really don't know, since I'm not in a position of ever having had to make that decision.
But I've never heard of somebody.
I would think most moral theologians would say no.
I've never heard of someone
Most moral theologians would say it's not a sin at all.
Right, and I've never heard of someone going.
There's nothing wrong with it.
You don't go to confession to report that you used birth control, do you?
Well, again, I've never had to do that, but.
Uh-huh.
I can't imagine that most of the women who use it would even dawn on them to do it.
Right. And so for this to be characterized as a fundamental moral precept of the Catholic Church that is being attacked by the secular American Obama government, that is flatly untrue.
Yeah, I mean, what you've got is it's a moral precept of the Catholic Church that's promoted by the Catholic hierarchy, on which they have been silent for a number of decades because they did know that the people weren't with them. I mean, when you go back to 1968, which is the Humanae Vitae document, which
right.
basically said, artificial contraception is kaput, okay, morally. That's when people started to leave the Catholic Church in droves. They voted with their feet. That was the beginning of the Exodus. And consequently, the bishops didn't say much about that issue for decades and decades. It's only quite recently that they've tried to resurrect it. And I, for the life of me, can't understand why they would be doing that now, that they don't understand that that's a loser.
And so, Maureen, these aggressive political operations related to abortion rights, related to birth control, related to same-sex marriage, are, you know, three very fundamental initiatives of the Roman Catholic Church in this country at this time.
Of the Roman Catholic hierarchy.
Thank you.
Which is not quite the same thing, anyway.
That's an important correction. And so this occurs at a time when the church is at its lowest ebb of credibility on personal sexual issues.
Right.
And this pains me. I take no pleasure in describing the widespread sexual abuse that has taken place and has been very clearly proven, the massive cash settlements that have been paid by archdioceses to victims at the expense of programs for the poor and schools and other vital mm-hmm. services. And fundamentally, the people who are promoting these policies in the political sphere are morally bankrupt in the perceptions of many of us here in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them to promote these hardline positions at this time when I believe they should be asking for forgiveness for their own failings and for the proven crimes that have been committed, both in terms of violating people and the cover-ups that have persisted. And yet they seem oblivious to their real standing in the eyes of many people.
I think that's true. The other thought that has flickered through my mind is how much of this is designed to deflect attention from the sex abuse crisis, which, of course, has dominated Catholic news for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
When you develop something that puts the blame for some major social wrongdoing on someone else, then it also is designed to shift people's attention away from what you're doing. It could be. That may not be their motive. I don't want to mm-hmm. read a motive in because I just don't know it. But the thought has gone through my head, though.
Yeah. And then we look at what's going on in the Vatican, which is a soap opera that's not being televised. But the butler has been leaking, and you know, they've bounced the head of the Vatican Bank, and
mm-hmm.
This one prelate who wanted to clean things up was sent as the Vatican ambassador to Washington to get him out of the way.
That's right.
I mean, they're operating with the same methods of a longstanding, say, cover up at the Pentagon.
Yeah, there's apparently I did an interview on this with the AP reporter in Rome not long ago, and apparently there's a lot of intrigue going on at the Vatican over the Vatican Bank, the possible misuse of funds, the fact that. According to what she said, the current Secretary of State of the Vatican is somebody that was appointed by Benedict XVI, but he had no diplomatic experience, no administrative experience. So in that kind of a position, he's earned himself a lot of enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of infighting going on. And some of that has resulted in these leaks and all kinds of internal struggle and who knows what, that they just don't want to become public.
Yeah. Now, against all this backdrop, we have a new initiative, I guess I would call it, coming from the Vatican to crack down on religious women in the United States.
Oh,
and
yes.
I'm looking at an op-ed by a man who I'm grateful that I met through you, Father Roy Bourgeois. He's been excommunicated because he participated in the ordination of a woman. Separate from these issues, he deserves great credit for his long stewardship of the protest of the School of the Americas at Fort mm-hmm. Benning, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a man who really represents a human moral compass in so many respects. And he writes in defense of the women who are now under a kind of assault from the Vatican, an attempt to crack down and forced American Catholic women, and particularly nuns, to conform. And this appears to be a new form of dictatorship, to take even further steps based on your vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, to force you to think the way the Vatican thinks you ought to be thinking.
Yes, except this isn't a new form of dictatorship. This is one that's been around for a while, which they're trying to resurrect. Let me say, I think there's a lot going on in this attempt by the Vatican to dictate to what is the leadership conference of women religious. Now, that's the organization of the elected leaders of all our congregations. And the first thing that your listeners ought to understand is that ever since the Second Vatican Council, the great reforming council of the church in the early 60s, we nuns have been part of communities that have highly collaborative democratic procedures. We're not used to being dictated to. Mother Superior ain't what she used to be. You know, she's much more likely to ask you your opinion than to tell you what to do, okay? In fact, they almost never tell you what to do. There's that background. But what's going on here, I think, is, first of all, a longstanding struggle in the Vatican to turn back the reforms of the Second Vatican Council. And for many of them, nuns represent those changes because we've been involved heavily in justice and peace. We have ignored some of their orders, you know, get thee back in thy habit, you know. All those kinds of things. And, you know, they look at us as the most visible example in the United States, I think, of the changes of the Second Vatican Council. So we're a target group, I think, for those who want to turn the clock back. And I think another thing that's going on here, quite literally, although you would never get any of these gentlemen in the Vatican to admit it, is a major desire by a male hierarchy to control women in the church. And I think that that's, you know, they've looked at nuns, they looked at what we're doing, and I'll tell you what I think really sticks in their craw, and that is the health reform legislation. And when it was first passed by the House of Representatives, if you remember, they were scrambling for the last few votes. The Catholic bishops were opposed to it. The Catholic nuns were in favor of it. The Catholic Health Association and Network, which is a social justice lobby run by nuns. And they, essentially the nuns, changed the last few votes that were needed for that health reform law. And they were quoted as real authorities in Roman Catholicism in the United States over against the bishops. In other words, the women's word was taken and the bishops was not.
Why did the bishops take a position opposing expansion of health care coverage? I have a lot of problems with Obamacare. But the thrust of it was to provide health care coverage for all Americans.
Which the bishops actually have had a historic position in favor of it. But some people in the bishops' conference believed it was going to fund abortion. Now, the nuns groups looked at this, and mind you, this is Carol Keenan, who heads the Catholic Health Association, Sister Carol Keenan. She's a right-to-life person. And she said, no, you're wrong. Other people and attorneys looked at this and said, no, this is not in the law. It was a question of interpreting that law. And I have to say, and I'm not surprised the nuns were correct, but they managed to convince the key legislators that this was also not the case and change their minds.
But toward the end of the process, if you recall, Bart Stupak, a conservative Catholic Democrat mm-hmm. from Michigan, essentially got the president to write a side letter mm-hmm. assuring that the Hyde Amendment was still in effect and that no funds could be used to pay for abortion. So
right.
that was clarified. So anybody who clinged to that notion was intent on embracing a red herring.
That's right. But the bishops clung to their opposition to that. Even to this day, they're still opposed to it, in spite of all of that.
Wow.
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me either, but that is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But the nuns, who are, you know, were quite rational about the whole thing, were highly supportive of it and really did a lot of very hard lobbying to help get that passed. And they would be the first to tell both of us, and I would certainly probably be agreeing with you, that my problems with Obamacare is it didn't go anywhere near far enough.
Yeah.
No public option in it. In fact, I would like to see single-payer health care. I'm sure most of them would, too.
Yeah.
But you take what you can get from a political perspective, and that was as much as we could get in 2010. So
now, Maureen Fiedler, coming back to this crackdown on the women religious conference here in the United States, this is being guided by Cardinal Levada. He was elevated to cardinal by Pope Benedict and brought in from San Francisco. And he's running the, what do we call that, the...
Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Right.
And people should know its old name was the Congregation, or rather the Holy Office of the Inquisition.
Exactly. It's the enforcement arm of the Catholic Church.
That's right.
So he has assigned, do I have this correct, the Bishop or Archbishop of Seattle, essentially to be the adult supervisor of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, and to essentially review almost every action, every public statement made for compliance with hardline Vatican principles. Is that correct?
Yes. Oh, yeah. He's supposed to oversee a revision of LCWR's, the Leadership Conference, that is, their statutes, their handbook, their plans, their programs, their conferences. He's supposed to vet their speakers. They're calling this a process of renewal, and nobody finds anything terribly renewing about it, I don't think, among the nuns. But that's what his assignment is. You're absolutely right. Now, if we were in the corporate world, this would be called a hostile takeover. I think that's pretty clear.
Well, and it seems like the next step will be to fit you out for electronic bracelets so that they can monitor every move you make.
Well, I'm sure there are some that might like to do that. I don't know. But let me say, it's very interesting to me to look at the responses that these women have made. And I know some of the women in the Leadership Conference, and they're really good people. Their statement after the first document was released said, basically, these are unsubstantiated accusations. Your process was so totally flawed and lacked any kind of transparency that it really didn't merit much. And they also turned tables and accused the Vatican of causing scandal and pain. Usually it's the Vatican that's accusing somebody else of causing scandal. But yet they did that. And then they went to Rome on their own initiative to present those concerns just yesterday, as a matter of fact, to officials at the Vatican. And I've looked at the reports that have come out of that, and it's hard to know what happened, you know, but because nobody is really saying. But my sense is that there was no meeting of the minds. It was all very cordial. It was all very polite. The women spoke their piece, and the men said, thank you very much, but you're still under our domain or whatever, and the women got up and left. And so they will come back to this country, and now the Leadership Conference will continue its process of deciding what to do.
Maureen, what troubles me most is that the people who posture as the moral leaders in our world are focused on what I consider to be not trivial, but insignificant personal morality, instead of the overarching challenges of our time. And, for instance, in the last 2 weeks, I've been lathered up about the disclosure that President Obama personally authorizes the killing of individuals using these unmanned aerial drones. Mm-hmm. And that concern reaches a peak when we look at the case of the American imam in Yemen, who appeared to have violated only free speech, where he advocated for attacks on the United States. But we've seen no proof that he was actively involved in any operation against the United States. And yet, you know, our nation sits passively back and accepts that the president has asserted he has the authority to mark people for execution. Mm-hmm. And I'm very troubled by this on both a political and moral level. And the silence, not only of our political leaders, which is a very important issue, but the silence of our alleged moral leaders. who are not challenging this president and saying, excuse me, I think this is fundamentally immoral. And that when you target people by remote control, we don't have evidence of exactly who they are or what they've done. We take a shot at a house in Pakistan and 14 people die. We announce that we once again killed the number two guy in Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And all of this is done without any verification, without any due process. And I consider this to be the big moral challenge of our time, not whether two guys can get married.
Yeah, it was one of many, but as you describe it, it occurred to me it could be called a right-to-life issue, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it really could. And there are many, I think, highly significant issues. Ironically, the Vatican accused the nuns in the original assessment of spending too much time on issues like that, like social justice and peace and the environment and so forth, and not spending any time at all, because they don't, on those, what I would call, loosely speaking, the reproductive issues and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we do need the bishops to be speaking out on issues like that, and they don't. I don't even know that they have a position on something like the drone attacks. And I think even now that human rights activists are just becoming finally activated over that kind of issue. But it is long-distance murder is what it is.
Yeah.
And I think it's very concerning.
Well, and at least on the political level, the response is not to investigate a potential crime. It's to stop the leaks that exposed that crime.
Yeah.
And I think that deserves a moral comment.
Yeah, it does. It does. You're right. But we're not hearing that. Actually, in all fairness to the Catholic bishops, I'm not hearing anybody talk about that as a moral issue except you.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm not hearing it from Judaism or mainline Protestantism or any of the normal moral voices in society. I suspect that Quakers and some of the peace churches would be very incensed over this and would make public statements. But other than that, and human rights activists have certainly become aware of that and have spoken on it. But
well, Maureen, as we wrap up here, I want to congratulate you and commend you for 10 years of your program, Interfaith Voices. And I'm just curious if these turn of events, the issues that we've been discussing here related to the mixing of religion and politics, the embrace of extreme religious viewpoints and the attempt to push them into the mainstream, did you ever expect things to evolve this way?
Well, I don't know what I expected when I started the show, I guess, but I have always seen ways in which religion can be pushed to extremes. I mean, we've certainly seen it in Islam. We've certainly seen it as you read the history of Christianity and Judaism. You know, it can happen in, I think, any faith tradition. It happens a little bit differently in a democracy, but it's why we have to be on guard against that, why we have organizations like Americans United for Separation of Church and State, for example, and why we have, you know, various groups that are watchdogs in this regard. So it's important, very important.
Well, Maureen, thanks for joining me today, and keep doing what you're doing.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter. It's good to have talked to you again.
Maureen Fiedler, the host of Interfaith Voices. Find it on your public radio station or at interfaithradio.org. Thanks for joining me today. Your comments are always welcome. Peter at peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until